Dr. Yu is an associate professor of surgery at Tufts here in Boston, and he's the chief of section of colorectal surgery. And he's going to give us a colorectal surgeon's perspective on what to do when you have a patient with synchronous metastasis, whether or not there is an option of simultaneous liver and colorectal resection. And you kind of give us a little pros, a little cons, a little bit more expanding on that, what Dr. Visser started.
Great. Thanks, Constantine and Michael, for inviting me to participate in this session. You know, as you can imagine, when you're the last speaker on a panel of talks, you're going to have a lot of your main points taken. So bear with me a little bit. Some of this is going to be redundant, but at least you can hear my perspective on some of these things. So I have no disclosures. So you've heard this over and over and over again. Patients with primary colorectal cancer, roughly 20% will present with synchronous metastatic disease. And only roughly 20% of those are actually candidates for surgical resection, which also, as you've heard, is their best chance for cure. And when you talk about the different surgical managements, it's controversial, right? No one really knows what the right approach is. And of course, for each individual patient, that's an individual decision. But the standard classic approach was to remove the primary colorectal tumor first, followed by chemotherapy, and then surgical treatment of the metastatic disease. And that approach had inherent disadvantages, right? So there was a delay in the treatment of the metastatic tumors, typically in the order of a few months. And if there was a complication from the initial surgery, that would delay that even further. And so other surgical approaches evolved, including the combined approach in which the primary colorectal cancer is removed simultaneously with the liver metastatic disease, and the liver-first approach, which Dr. Visser has just outlined. So I've been asked to talk about the pros and cons of the simultaneous approach. Brendan touched on that a little bit, but I'll again give you my perspective. Najia mentioned this earlier. You know, surgery for rectal cancer, it's very different than surgery for colon cancer. First of all, for locally advanced rectal cancer, we like to treat with neoadjuvant chemotherapy and radiation. And so you're adding another element of complexity to an already complex medical and surgical situation. For rectal cancer, we're operating in the pelvis. You can see in that image, it's a fixed, narrow space. It's often a very complicated surgery, and the morbidity and the mortality rates are higher than for colon surgery. And so when you're thinking about performing a combined operation with a liver resection, it does require some pause. The other issues that were mentioned by Dr. Visser, you know, the rectum in the abdominal compartment is about as far away from the liver as you can be. And so when you're thinking about how you're going to approach that with two different surgeons, two different teams, whether you're doing it laparoscopically or open, it requires a lot of conversations about who goes first, what your incisions are, and that's, I think, also unique to your particular institution in terms of what your areas of expertise are. Lastly, you know, I'm going to review the medical literature and go over a few key studies, but it's important to remember that the data's really not very good. It's all retrospective. When the studies are comparing combined surgery with staged approaches, they're all non-randomized, so there's inherent selection bias, which I'll demonstrate in a few of the studies. Most are single-institution studies, and again, most don't differentiate colon cancer from rectal cancer, so we're trying to extrapolate from data that's largely related to colon surgery. So I'll just go straight to the punchline first in terms of the pros and cons as I see it. The first, obviously, and this has been mentioned before, it's one operation, it's one anesthetic setting, and so it saves the patient from a second hospitalization, a second operation. It also avoids delays in treatment. For a typical staged approach, the time interval is on the order of 3 to 4 months, and again, that can be delayed if there are complications from the initial operation. Same is true for the initiation of chemotherapy. There have been many studies looking at morbidity, mortality rate, survival. Again, most single institution and retrospective. But the majority show that compared to a staged approach, the combined approach has equivalent morbidity and mortality rates and equivalent survival rates as well. There are several studies that looked at length of stay and showed that with a combined approach, it's actually much shorter. And some recent data that also suggests, as you might imagine, that that is also associated with lower costs. In my opinion, my bias, there are more pros than cons to this if it's the right patient. One of the benefits is also a potential contraindication, and that is that it's one operation. So you're combining two really complicated surgeries in one setting. It's a lot of surgery, it's long hours, and in the wrong patient, that can be devastating. And there's some data that in certain situations that maybe the morbidity is actually higher. It's interesting to hear Dr. Visser talk about his worry in the setting of an APR. For me, I worry about the major hepatectomy. So we tend to worry less about the specialty that's not our own. Okay, so sorry that's cut off. This is the first study I just wanted to review. It's a retrospective multi-institutional study, so it involves three experienced high-volume centers, Duke, Johns Hopkins, MD Anderson. They looked at 610 patients that underwent surgery for this situation, spanning from 1985 to 2006, so it includes an older population. And you can see that the majority of the patients during this time interval had a staged approach. Only 22% had a combined operation. Of those groups, 40% in the combined group had rectal cancer, only 23% in the stage group. So certainly more reflective of colon cancer in this setting. Also, patients in the combined group had fewer and smaller metastases and were less frequently undergoing a major hepatectomy. So this is some of the selection bias we all refer to. Taking all that into account, when you compare the morbidity rates of combined and staged surgeries, basically no difference in overall morbidity and severe morbidity, and in terms of complication rates specifically related to liver surgery and to the colorectal surgery. They did find that in the combined group, the rate of severe complications was higher in patients that underwent a major hepatectomy, and they saw a non-significant higher mortality as well. They looked at length of stay, and the median length of stay for the combined approach was 8 days versus 14 days. And the authors concluded that a major hepatectomy was an independent predictor of severe morbidity after these combined operations. Let's jump to a more recent study. This is in 2017. I think someone might have mentioned this earlier. This was from Jeff Milsom's group at Cornell. Again, a study published in 2017. And they utilized the New York State SPARCS database. So this is a database that collects all of the operations that are done in the state of New York. And they found 1,430 patients who underwent surgery for colorectal cancer with simultaneous liver metastases between 2005 and 2014, so a more contemporary study. And it's interesting, here you see in this group that actually the majority of the patients underwent a combined approach, so 76% versus 24% who underwent a staged operation. My sense is that a combined approach is sort of gained in popularity and is also, I would say, maybe a preferred approach in the right situation, but I'm interested to hear from the panel about that. It seems to be the trend in this study anyway. Again, the median duration between the stage surgeries was a little over 3 months. And they found no difference in either major morbidity events or anastomotic leakage. This included patients that underwent a hepatic lobectomy, so 14% in the combined group and 31% in the stage group, and included patients that had complex colorectal surgery, so low anterior resections, APRs. And they found that patients that underwent the combined surgery were less likely to have a prolonged length of stay, were less likely to have high hospital charges, and were less likely to be readmitted within 30 days. They also did do a subset analysis looking specifically at patients with rectal cancer. So that included pretty high numbers of patients, 363 patients in the combined group and 109 in the stage group. And they had the same results, no difference in major events, anastomotic leak rates, and the same benefits of the combined operation. The last study I wanted to review is from Memorial, again published in 2015. And of course, some of this data was included probably in that New York Sparks database study. This is a retrospective single institution study from Memorial, 198 patients who underwent surgery from 1984 to 2008. Again, the majority had a combined approach, 73% versus 27% in the staged group. And what was an important point for me here is that there's a fair number of these patients that had major liver resections, so 35% in the entire group, but in the combined group it was even higher, it was actually 44% of those patients. The mean interval for the time between surgeries in the stage group was 5 months, with a median of about 3 months. And again, they found no difference in complication rates, and the combined group had a shorter OR time, less blood loss, and a shorter length of stay. My take-home point from this is that, you know, I think in really high-volume tertiary and quaternary care centers that are skilled in taking care of patients and doing these kinds of large operations, that a hepatectomy or APR, whatever it is that you're combining together, they may do just as well. Okay. And so to just segue into the discussion, which I think is going to be the most interesting part of this session, when you're thinking about what to do, of course, and this has been mentioned over and over again, it's something that's individualized, it happens on a case-by-case basis, involves multidisciplinary services, and it's based on what the main oncologic problem is, what's symptomatic, what's the level of expertise at your particular institution in terms of whether you do a combined operation or staged, and obviously proper patient selection. I would just say that for a combined approach, I think, you know, the data is somewhat weak, but I think what we can say is that it's a combined approach is safe, that outcomes are equivalent, and maybe you need to be cautious when you're doing really big combined surgeries together. Thank you.
Thanks, very good. Thank you. Okay, we'll take some questions from the audience, or everybody can leave.
Don't you? Everybody just get off the news.
Wow. Not everybody. So I have a question for the colorectal surgeons. Resectable rectal cancer. You get your MRI and you're happy. You can take this out with an R0 resection, but you have simultaneous resectable, really low volume, low risk liver disease. Doesn't require some big operation, crazy operation, say a left lateral segmentectomy. Are you going to give radiation to that tumor? Both easily resectable.
So both are resectable. Am I going to give radiation to that tumor? Possibly. In lieu of chemotherapy up front?
Sorry, assuming you want to get to a surgical strategy. You're not trying to do watch and wait.
Right.
For example.
Yeah, but so you're asking, if you give chemotherapy up front.
Sure.
And then So it depends. You have to assess the primary after you give your chemotherapy. Okay. So if it's a bulky lesion and, you know, it's a T3 lesion, then I think that giving some sort of therapy up front, whether it's chemo alone, doing a chemo first approach or doing chemotherapy and radiation is appropriate. I think that, you know, there's ample evidence to suggest that even with a total mesorectal excision, it improves your R0 resection and your negative circumferential margin. So, but it sort of, that question sort of speaks to the, you know, sort of the whole gist of the panel, is that you have to individualize the treatment. So looking at that MRI, it's not just about, is it there or is it not there? It's about, okay, where is it? Middle, upper, you know, lower rectum, how far does it get into the mesorectum? Does it encroach upon the circumferential radial margins? Is there nodal disease associated with it? So all of those questions have to be answered before you sort of make that decision. So, sorry.
No, complicated. That's kind of where we're headed, I think.
I mean, what I would say to that is that that my criteria for giving neoadjuvant radiation before surgery for rectal cancer, for me, it doesn't really change a whole lot. When you're considering the metastatic disease, so right. I treat it the same way, And that might mean doing a liver-first approach so that they can get the radiation before I do the surgery. It's interesting because all the data out there about, you know, the surgery and the situation, the one outcome that no one that I'm aware of has addressed is, does the local recurrence rate change? Because I think some patients with rectal cancer aren't getting their standard neoadjuvant treatment. And I'd be curious to know if in this setting, in those patients that aren't getting neoadjuvant radiation, are their local recurrence rates actually higher?
I don't know about they're higher, but I will say from when we studied this, the natural history of those patients, 95% of them, the ones that die of metastatic disease. Very rarely they die of pelvic failure.
Yeah, I agree.
But so it's a tough one. Anyway, well, let's...
Go ahead, introduce yourself.
Hi, Joe Tronzo, Cleveland. I have a question for the colorectal surgeons and one for the patibiliary surgeons. The colorectal side, when you're working on a rectal cancer simultaneous and you have locally advanced disease, which means you're looking at an exoneration to get actually an R0 resection, how does that change your algorithm? I'm faced with that right now. And then for the patibiliary surgeons, as far as trying to not do too much surgery, when do you utilize ablation to sort of get that single surgery combined intervention to lessen the blow of a large operation?
Go ahead.
So doing an exonerative procedure where when you say locally advanced, you're talking about T4
T4 with liver metastases.
So that's a very difficult situation, and those are exactly the kinds of situations that you want to be well aware of before you go into the operating room, because I do think, you know, we're debating today whether or not to do rectal cancer simultaneously with liver metastases, much less taking out other adjacent organs. I think that there is additional morbidity conferred by doing exonerative surgery in the pelvis. I do. I think that's a big hit. If it's a small liver lesion, if it's a left lateral segmentectomy, for example, if it's a relatively small case, then I think that you can go ahead and do that. I do. But you have to understand what the patient's underlying comorbidities are. You know, this is maybe an okay case in somebody who's 50, but not an okay case in somebody who's 75 with, aortic stenosis. So you have to game this out very carefully and understand all the moving parts.
I don't have a whole lot to add to that other than, you know, I would want to know about who that patient is, if they young and the old, how motivated are they, how aggressive does the team want
to
be?
You get faced with that motivation when you're trying to tell them they can't survive this operation. And it's what really struggles is you can't get them past the idea that losing your bladder and your rectum is not going to cure you of your disease. And I think that's one of the things I struggle with this patient personally. But
I think from a hepatobiliary standpoint, you asked the question about how often to use ablation and so forth. I mean, in my kind of overly simplistic mind, I always try to do a single operation if possible. Now, that being said, I try not to combine two, quote, big operations. I'll do a big and a small, I'll do a small and a big, but combining two big operations, in my experience, is prone to having a lot of morbidity. And so I am apt, for the peripheral lesions, I may just, if it's bilobar disease, I may at least try it in one stage. If there are a couple of small wedges, knowing that maybe my margins are close, I may have to come back and do another operation or do another ablation. Or for deeper lesions, bilobar disease, I'll ablate them, knowing that there's probably a higher local recurrence rate, meaning that I may need to do a second stage operation anyway. I think the risks are low and the reward is high.
Thanks.
I mean, I am not a super heavy ablator myself. I think, the one challenge with ablation, if it's not the right, I mean, I ablate, and I ablate because it's an augmentation of surgery. If I'm resecting, and then I'm going to have to ablate something else to leave an adequate FLR. And I think there's occasional small lesions central in the right liver that if you ablate them, you're going to save a whole heck of a lot of parenchyma. I am also cautious, though, of doing an operation that's just going to obscure my next stage. So, like, if I ablate something and I don't have a good shot at it, and I know, and it's not really what I want to do, and now all of a sudden I have some radiographic artifact and I'm not sure, and I'm going to be struggling over when the local recurrence occurs, and every scan report's going to be a little murky. So if they need to do a pelvic exoneration and I'm not happy about what I'm going to be doing in the liver, I would probably just fight the liver battle another day. Yep. And then start with a clean slate and really address the liver in the way I wanted to optimally.
Bill Heald from Basingstoke, England, and speaking really from Champalimo Foundation in Portugal, where we have particular experience of using volume modulated arc therapy very cleverly guided by imaging, MR of course, and experience in prostate cancer of reducing the number of doses down to single dose focused VMAT radiation. And I think one of the things I've really loved all your presentations, which are thoughtful and exciting, I was particularly excited by you saying that you're never under-treating with the chemo your rectal cancer. So it seems to me that the most hopeful thing that comes out of this is that we can get our radiation oncologists to work out what the best dose is to give when you've treated the liver secondary adequately with chemo. What is the best dose, and preferably short course or even shorter course for the rectum? Because I think you'll find that a lot of those rectums will not need to be attended to at all, as indeed you implied already with regular radiation. I think the radiation oncologists can do a lot more for us than they are doing in general at the moment. Your comments, sorry.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that sometimes they, that there are more tools in their toolkit than they use.
Yeah.
I think that we underuse in this country short course radiation. We underuse it fairly dramatically. There are only a few centers that are actually using it. I think that this disease, stage four in colorectal cancer, requires flexibility of approach and thought and creativity along certain guidelines much more than many other of the other diseases that we treat. So I'm very interested to hear about ARC therapy. Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Tom Clancy from Brigham and Boston. I'd be interested in hearing from our hepatobiliary colleagues with some of the following situations. We see more and more patients now. We're treating a lot of patients who don't just have liver disease presenting in synchronous metastasis, but also have liver disease in the lung. And granted, I suspect that, as Dr. Visser points out, these are always highly individualized cases in terms of how they're sequenced. But I'd be interested in hearing how this is handled at different institutions in terms of how you sequence the liver and the lung.
That's a great question. So now we're talking three locations. How are we going to sequence? We can't decide on how to sequence two. So I can tell you, anecdotally at my center, I'm sure you have the similar experience. I mean, truthfully, it depends on the burden of disease and the size of the operations. I mean, for instance, you see, the difference between an indeterminate pulmonary nodule and a known documented metastases in the lung. You know, I have to say, for the most part, I won't let the thoracic surgeons know this, but people tolerate VATS lobectomies and VATS wedge resections pretty darn well. We even have experience doing some liver resections and doing the lung resection through the diaphragm at the same time. So it's, I don't think we can protocolize that. I think it's a really difficult discussion.
I agree. It's not that uncommon that you have one or two, 8 millimeter lung lesions. Typically, that is the these lung lesions seem to have a very indolent course much of the time. They don't explode on you overnight. So truthfully, they are typically the problem that we solve after the abdominal tumor, and then decide if they're going to get wedged or SBRT'd or occasionally ablated percutaneously.
I would say this is the least controversial thing we're discussing today. we haven't figured out what to do with the rectum and the liver and how to sequence all of that, but the lung can definitely be left behind. It's indolent. They're not always malignant, and we can wait on those for sure. Yeah. I think we'll all agree with that.
Thanks.
Good. Costa, you want to say something?
I want to ask a question to our colorectal colleagues. In the situation, Dr. Mahmoud, Jim, if you have a patient who has been treated with, call it, total neoadjuvant chemoradiation and has excellent response, but not quite the complete response, and they undergo liver-first surgery, so now the liver is completely clear. They have been off chemotherapy and they're resting, and then they have residual remaining rectal cancer, let's say mid-rectum, down from 5 to 2 centimeter lesion, clearly positive but smaller. What would be a strategy?
So this sounds like, you know, you want to treat the disease and cure it, so you're treating with intent to cure, so you have to go forward and do your proctectomy. Is that what you mean?
But I would like to play a little bit of a devil's advocate. What if the patient says that they're completely asymptomatic, the lesion is small, and they feel well?
So you know, if you've been able to clear the liver and get an R0 resection at your liver, then you have to talk to the patient about the fact that although, you know, survival statistics for stage 4 disease, 5-year, 10-year survival is lower, that they're really their only meaningful chance of taking advantage of that 25 to 35% chance of being disease-free at 5 years is to go forward and have your proctectomy. Because if your rectum has not responded after total neo-chemo adjuvant therapy, then the rectum's not going to remain asymptomatic for long, right? It's going to start growing back, and they're going to become symptomatic, and you've lost your chance. That window is going to close, and you've lost your chance. So I think that just a good discussion of the data and the fact that you're treating them with intention to cure them, I think, is essential.
I completely agree.
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Jim. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we're being very aggressive in these patients and trying to give them their best chance for cure, and so I wouldn't hesitate to recommend proctectomy in that situation. I think if you're talking about an asymptomatic primary in someone that has unresectable liver disease, that's a harder sell for me.
Totally different situation.
One thing that people forget is the cure rate for limited resectable liver metastases and rectal cancer with complete resection is probably 4 or 5 times out of pancreas cancer. We don't hesitate to resect pancreas cancer.
Yeah. Well said.
Unfortunately.
Dr. Williams. Hi, Rochelle Williams, University of Maryland. I wanted to ask the HPV surgeons again about how they do stage liver resections. We didn't really talk about that. So people with bilobar liver metastases with their rectal cancer and how you can't take out all their disease in one. Of course, you'd want to do that, but sometimes you can't. And maybe with a staged approach, you could render them disease-free. How do you guys approach that?
I'm supposed to be the moderator.
If I go first, then they can both criticize what I... So it's hard, because this is so customized. There's traditional two-stagers, and then there's ALPS, and those people sometimes like to bicker in public. So, for example, if somebody has bilobar disease, if the first stage of a two-stage can be done laparoscopically, I think that's a great approach, because that's pretty straightforward, low impact, then you can PV them and go do your right liver, usually. Truthfully, for some young patients, we do an occasional ALPS, because, again, 2 open hepatectomies staged 6 or 8 weeks apart is a lot to ask of somebody. I don't think ALPS is a salvation, but I think for metastatic disease, not primary liver cancer, ALPS has a role, and I think now there's growing data that in well-selected patients there's a role for that. Honestly, there's a few things in between. There's some intriguing things. You know, sometimes if you can laparoscopically take something off the left lateral or ablate it, and then maybe just ablate some of that line, people call it lap ALPS or mini ALPS, that can also accelerate this, and you're not having such a physiologic impact. So it's so geographically based, it's hard to answer that more broadly.
Were you asking in the context of how to deal with the rectum as well?
Yeah, so in that multidisciplinary approach of timing everything else.
Go ahead, man.
I think everything that was said, obviously, I agree with. I think, you know, for the most part, just to generalize, when you have the colon primary in place and you have bilobar disease and you're worried about your future liver remnant, we've treated the majority of those by, obviously, some perioperative chemotherapy. They go and they have the colon resected at the same time as preferably a minimally invasive liver resection, so usually a couple wedges on the left side or something. They recover. they get chemotherapy while if they need a portal vein embolization, they get the portal vein embolization. If they don't need the portal vein embolization, they just get about 2 months of chemotherapy and then another resection, to generalize it.
Thank you.
Wolfgang Gertner from Minnesota. So as we become more TNTologists and patients are getting increased rates of sphincter-preserving surgery, is there anybody in a patient with a complete clinical response who you would actually not offer watch and wait to in the setting of colorectal liver metastases?
That's a good question.
So it depends on whether, if they had unresectable liver metastases or oligometastatic disease, I think that
let's say that they do have curative intent.
Then I think, yes. If they have a clinical complete response and they meet all the criteria for a clinical complete response, then I think that having that conversation with them, just as you would with someone who does not have distant metastatic disease, is something that you need to be able to do. I think it's a legitimate approach, but I think you have to, I think that because selection criteria is in flux, these folks have to be followed very closely. I guess that's what I was implying in my talk. I think it's certainly legitimate to offer these people a watch and wait approach, maybe more so, right, than someone who has no distant metastatic disease. But the same conversation applies. Have to talk to them the same way, quote the same data, because we don't have additional data specific for those people who have clinical complete responses in the setting of distant metastatic disease. I've certainly done it, and I do it. And I think it's a nice approach for those people.
And just as a follow-up question, how long are you waiting as you're giving more chemotherapy up front, maybe liver stage surgery, chemoradiation, are you waiting longer before surgery or shorter, the interval between completion of radiation and surgery?
So, you know, I wait 8 weeks. I tend to wait a shorter amount of time when I'm talking about doing a combined procedure. You sort of want to get on with things, so I'll wait, you know, four to six weeks. But any shorter than that can get a little bit dicey. I worry about my anastomosis if I'm doing a sphincter-preserving procedure. And also patients, you know, they're a little sicker and they don't recover as well. So I'll shorten it up a little, by a few weeks.
Again, it's always individualized. Generally, I like to wait the same amount of time. I think in certain situations where short course radiation is indicated, then that obviously would change the timing.
And ask, what is this close follow-up? Like, I've had patients where the where we were planning combined, and then all of a sudden Andy Shelton would say, "I don't feel anything. I'm just going to watch it."
Yep.
So what is close follow-up?
What is close follow-up in watch and wait, or
after
in general?
A complete clinical response.
Right? So for there's, you know, a watch and wait protocol, there are a bunch of them out there, but basically I think that the most important part of it is the imaging and your physical examination. So for a watch and wait protocol at Penn, we look at these patients every month for the first 3 or 4 months, more than that really, for the first 6 months. Those patients are coming back to my office so I can directly visualize that area. After that, we go out to 2 to 3 months, but your highest rate of recurrence is going to be in that first 2 years. So that's when you have to keep an eye on them. There are, you know, I showed a couple of pictures of a complete clinical response, and those patients, you know it when you see it. It's one of those kinds of things. You know, it's completely white. There's no dimpling. There's maybe a little bit of ectasia there. You can't really feel it. It's a very characteristic, stereotypical look when someone's had a complete clinical response that you know is overwhelmingly likely going to stick.
Like a procto and an
EOS? You can procto and do a physical examination. And we do pelvic MRI to follow these folks. And we do pelvic MRI every 3 months, as long as the insurance companies will let us, because, you know, as you know, that's a real big battle.
Go ahead.
I'd be actually curious to hear what Dr. Heald's thoughts are on that. But, you know, for me, generally, the watch and wait approach makes me nervous. I don't feel like the physical exam is reliable in any way. And we've all been in situations where, of course, it looks like there's a complete pathologic response, but at the time of resection, you see some microscopic disease. I think that in this particular situation, it's more of an argument, as Najia said, to do that. But generally, I'm personally not a big fan of it.
I have a technical question for the group. If you go to the OR for a combined resection, say you're going to do a left hepatectomy and a low anterior resection, who goes first? And what prevents you from moving on to the second half, whatever that second half is? We have a very standard way of doing it, but I suspect it's very different everywhere.
Well, you know, when I was at UCLA, we did our surgeries laparoscopically, and the liver surgeons did theirs open. And so it was kind of awkward to do the liver surgery first. So we went first.
Liver surgery is always awkward.
I mean, for the most part, at our center, the hepatobiliary surgeons go first just because we like to think we're better than the colorectal surgeons. But now, logically, the thought process is, you know, we do our operation with low CVP, so you're going to run the patient dry at the beginning of the operation. They can catch up while the colon portion is done. And also just the contamination of the instruments. You know, you can change instrument trays, but obviously the colon surgeons are filthy and the liver surgeons are clean. So we like to use clean instruments when we cut through the liver.
So go ahead. I wanted to follow up on this note, but what if the staged surgery must be performed in sort of a hypothetical patient where has liver metastasis in the left lobe and let's say a patient otherwise would require an APR? And I know there's a lot of variability, but in this hypothetical scenario, what would you recommend first, liver first or rectum first?
We would generally go liver first on the grounds that there is a lower likelihood that the liver operation will result in complications that will delay chemo or the second operation compared to the opposite.
I would agree. If somebody needs an APR, I think it, particularly if somebody needs an APR, I would go liver first and allow them to, you know, sort of have a longer colostomy-free life or better function. I would agree. Right. And at Penn, we you know, also do a liver-first approach, most likely, because primarily because of the fluid management aspect of it.
That's
even
really
with good. Even with ERAS, you know, even when we're running dry from a colorectal point of view, I think it makes sense to do a liver-first.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sorry, you got the short stuff. You did well with it.
I know, but the problem is that I'm irresponsible, so I did my...